The headlines this hour: crowds of mourners attend a funeral ceremony in the Iranian capital for a member of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps who was assassinated on Sunday. The death toll from the collapse of a building in southern Iran rises to 11 as rescue workers race against time to pull possible survivors from the rubble. And political crisis deepening in Tunisia. The labor union prepares for a nationwide strike after rejecting a national dialogue proposed by the president. This is News. Thanks for joining us. We begin this hour in the Iranian capital, Tehran, where earlier today a funeral procession was held for a member of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps who was assassinated on Sunday. Hundreds of mourners attended the event, many of them holding pictures of Colonel Hassan Sayyad Khodayi and chanting slogans against the United States and Israel. Khodayi was assassinated in his car and just outside of his home in an eastern Tehran neighborhood. He was shot 5 times by 2 motorcyclists. The IRGC has called his killing an act of terrorism. The IRGC top commander, Major General Hossein Salami, has pledged to avenge Khodayi's assassination, saying the response will be tough and make the enemies regret the heinous crime. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi has returned home from his groundbreaking visit to Oman. Raisi says that the visit opened a new chapter in the two countries' relations. Let's see what else he had to say about the visit.
We don't have much economic relations, and over the past couple of months, our business relations has doubled and stands at over $1 billion. But we believe that there's a lot of potential in order to develop these relations further. And as far as business relations are concerned, both countries and high-ranking officials of the two countries have signed MOUs in order to develop business and economic relations. In short, 13 MOUs and agreements were signed by the high-ranking officials of Iran and Oman. And this is considered a new page and a new chapter in our relations. Of course, we did have agreements that were signed before, but what really matters is for these agreements to be implemented. And, of course, one issue that was brought up is that these MOUs are not implemented. So this trip is considered a beginning of a new era in order to start implementing these MOUs. The basic pillar of these agreements are mostly regarding fiscal cooperation and also health tourism. Another issue that is important is that the bilateral relations between Iran and Oman can help strong regional relations, and good relations between the two countries can increase cooperation in the region, which was discussed in this meeting and all of the meetings that we had with high-ranking Omani officials. And we are pursuing stronger relations both with Oman and in the region.
Earlier, we were joined by the chairman of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, Masoud Shajareh. He says the relationship between Iran and Oman has served as a pillar of security and stability for waterways in the Persian Gulf region.
And that relationship has served both Oman and Iran, and indeed has actually been a pillar of stability and security for the waterways, as was mentioned before, and the whole of the Persian Gulf region. And that is an exactly one of the reasons why this should be indeed extended elsewhere among the neighbors in the Persian Gulf region. And those who are refusing to go down this route or creating obstacles, they're only serving a very twisted interest of people outside the region. And they're not, say, serving the interest of the region or regional countries or indeed international safety and security and benefit to region and beyond. And so, therefore, it really just makes sense. I mean, the example of Oman is really a great reason why it should be extended elsewhere.
Turning now to Iran's southwestern city of Abadan, where rescuers are combing through the rubble of a collapsed building for survivors. So far, at least 11 people are confirmed dead, and there are fears that the number of casualties could rise, with reports saying that up to 50 people remain trapped under the debris. Some 33 people have already been pulled from the 10-story building that came down on Monday. The collapse has blocked the city's busiest road. The surrounding buildings have all been evacuated. The provincial governor says, based on initial technical assessments, questionable construction practices are the leading cause of the tragedy. 10 people, including the city's mayor and several people involved in the construction of the major trade center, are in detention. The owner is said to have lost his life in the incident. Now let's listen to the comments by the president of the Iran Red Crescent Society, Pir Hossein Kolivand, about the ongoing rescue operations at the site.
Rescue teams are working to their fullest potential. Operations are in progress at a higher speed thanks to the deployment of more and better equipment to the area. We are trying to access the underground level to save those trapped there. All buildings in the vicinity of the collapsed structure have been evacuated to protect residents from potential risks.
Iran's foreign ministry says the United States' open support for Israel has further emboldened the occupying regime. The ministry spokesman, Saeed Khatibzadeh, says this has been worsened by international indifference to the regime's repeated acts of aggression against Syria. Khatibzadeh condemned Israel's recent missile strikes on Damascus, saying the regime's military is serving the air force of terrorist groups operating in Syria. He said that Israel launches attacks whenever the Syrian army scores a victory against terror outfits. The spokesman also underlined the need for a strong response to Israeli acts of aggression both on the battlefield and at the international level. On Friday, Israel launched a large-scale missile attack on Damascus, killing 3 people and razing buildings near a key mosque in the city. Tunisia's political crisis deepening. The country's labor union rejects the president's proposed national dialogue and says that it will hold a nationwide strike over economic woes. The UGTT says that it will not take part in an advisory committee set up by President Kais Saied to discuss political and economic reforms. The union says that it rejects any dialogue where roles are unilaterally determined. Last week, Saied designated a law professor to head the Committee of Legal and Political Science Experts to draft a new constitution. However, he barred political parties from any role in the process. The main opposition party in Nahda has also rejected Saied's move, saying that it lacks constitutional legitimacy. Tunisia has been in a deep political crisis since June 2021, when Saied dismissed the government, suspended parliament, and assumed executive authority. The president's opponents accuse him of a coup. Despite EU efforts to boycott Russian energy, Italy has increased its imports of crude oil from Moscow to feed its refineries. As a result, Rome is set to become the EU's largest importer of Russian crude. This report from Max Gibelli from Rome.
The petrochemical complex of Augusta Priolo is a vast industrialized coastal area in eastern Sicily, which includes one of Europe's largest oil refineries, the ISAB plant. This refinery processes about 14% of Italy's crude, about 10.6 million tons a year, and exports in dozens of countries around the world. Owned by the Moscow-based company Lukoil, the ISAB refinery has been forced to rethink its supply strategy as the EU is aiming to get rid of its dependence on Russian energy following the conflict in Ukraine. Since lenders and oil companies have stopped providing financing and crude to Lukoil after Brussels imposed sanctions on the Kremlin, the ISAB refinery is only left to rely on supplies from Russia.
Although Lukoil is not under sanctions, banks and insurance companies prefer not to work with Russian ones. Lukoil can only process Russian crude. That's why, in order to keep the company running, the import of crude oil has increased significantly in Italy.
Moscow has exported about 450,000 barrels per day of crude to Italy in May, more than four times as much as it did before the start of the conflict in Ukraine, and the most since 2013. Rome may soon become the EU's largest Russian crude importer, this despite Brussels urging all members of the bloc to cut ties to Russian energy.
Some unions and think tanks have warned that a total Russian oil embargo would have the immediate effect of shutting down not only the ISAB refinery, but also other large petrochemical plants and many smaller companies in the area. This would result in the loss of thousands of jobs and an enormous damage to the national and local economy.
This definitely risks aggravating the employment situation in Italy's already depressed south. It's paradoxical. Brussels wanted to penalize Russian energy imports, but in Italy it's actually been incentivized by the sanctions. And there is also the Russian gas issue. It's going to take at least 2-3 years before Italy manages to cut its dependency on Moscow.
Members of the bloc have yet to reach an agreement on an embargo on Russian oil. This way, the Russian energy industry has largely avoided direct bans.
Two solutions have been suggested to the problem. Either Italy continues this way until a full embargo on the Russian crude is imposed, or the Russian company gets nationalized with its assets being put under special administration by Italy's government.
Energy analysts have noted that Russian crude exports have also increased to the port of Trieste near Italy's northeastern border with Slovenia, where the oil is delivered through the Transalpine pipeline to two other Russian-owned refineries in Germany. Max Civili, Rome.
2 years after George Floyd's murder, nearly 8 in 10 black Americans say that there has been little to no improvement in how U.S. police treat black people. Hashtag Trending takes a review of how racism and white supremacy are deeply entrenched in the fabric of the U.S.
Hey everyone, welcome to another Hashtag Trending with me, your host Ali Reza. The issue of racism and white supremacy has always been a hot topic in the U.S., at least in recent memory, and now a recent mass shooting in the state of New York has again brought up the topic. Well, maybe I shouldn't say brought up the topic, but rather made it a hot topic again about acts of racially motivated violent extremism. A new study has found that 3/4 of black Americans are concerned that they or someone they care about in their community will be physically injured because they are black. Now, this study comes in the aftermath of a recent mass shooting in Buffalo where a white American gunman shot dead 10 people and injured 3 others. The poll shows some 75% of black Americans believe that white supremacy is a bigger problem now compared to what it was 5 years ago. Most of the respondents also said that half or more white people in the U.S. hold white supremacist tendencies or beliefs. Our first comment comes from Mike Klonsky on Twitter. 2 years after George Floyd's murder, nearly 8 in 10 black Americans say there has been little or no improvement in how police treat black people, according to a Washington Post Ipsos poll. Reese has our next tweet. They only remember if the victims are Jewish or white. They don't care about black Americans. When it comes to us, it's muffin ears and revisionist history. As soon as the word racism is floated as a motive, whites become ostriches with their head in the sand, libs and cons alike. I would say liberals are just better at pretending that they care about the issue. EJ Dion said, racism holds back all of us, so the fight against racism must be multiracial. Its evil leads to deadly violence against black Americans. Its political impact divides Americans who should come together on behalf of a shared project for justice. Many say the Buffalo shooting once again unveiled the systemic racism in the U.S. that causes the death of African Americans as well as other ethnic groups. They are urging the authorities to put an end to white supremacy and gun violence once and for all. Our next tweet comes from Ahmed Ali. Still can't get over how a week ago 10 people were murdered for simply being black, for simply living their lives. To exist as a black person is to constantly negotiate in order for your humanity to be seen. It's exhausting and erodes the foundation of our society. Dave Malouf said, while some may want to fight against the death, we all have in many ways normalized death in this country, at least in part. If not COVID or mass shootings, then it's the systematic racism causing the deaths of black Americans and other BIPOC for generations. BIPOC refers to the term, it's an abbreviation for black indigenous people of color. Jeffrey St. Clair counterpunch as our next tweet. The Buffalo shooting will be used to increase funding for police. The same police who didn't stop the racist shooter, who have aligned themselves with white supremacist movements, and who regularly shoot young blacks suspected of committing minor offenses like jaywalking. Millennial Fairy Sarah said, once again, the Buffalo shooting is a truly awful tragedy that was also potentially preventable. Racism, white supremacy, and gun violence must not be allowed to continue. Others say that the silence from the white community regarding the Buffalo shooting is sad but not surprising, as any other debates, such as the discussion around abortion laws, seems to be more important to the American community than the loss of black lives. Our final batch of comments starts with a tweet by Brooke Eyre. AIPAC is proving their racism every damn day and is attacking black Americans. Their only crimes are being progressives who are fighting to make America the nation it promises to be, and they believe that Palestinians deserve basic human rights. Dr. Carmen Reese-Foster has our next tweet. Let's talk about the impact of white supremacist violence on the mental health of black people. If we allow racism to go without accountability and create policies that enable white violence, black lives and black mental health are in danger. Race-based trauma is real. Faith B said, I'm not surprised by the silence from the white evangelical community when it comes to racism. Last week, people were arguing about abortion and the value of life, and this week, they are silent at the loss of black lives. Yalzi has our final tweet. Why is it so hard for white people to believe that racism is hatred based on race? There are people who see black people and go into a rage. They have lived their lives believing that black people are inherently dumb, violent, and need to be eradicated or controlled. That's been it for another Hashtag Trending. Thank you. Take care and bye-bye.
And that is for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Insight.
Welcome to Insight. On this episode, we will be discussing the present and future of Albania in a conversation with Albanian historian and author Olsi Yazici. But first, this brief analysis.
Albania is a small country we rarely hear about in the news. One of the reasons for this is that the US decided to turn this southern Balkan state on the Adriatic coast into a base of operations against Russia and Muslim countries such as Iran and Turkey in the early 2000s. Beyond its geographic location, it is the fact that Albania is the only Muslim-majority nation in Europe, with approximately 70% of the population adhering to Islam, that made it a target for US domination. Following the collapse of communism in the 1990s, the US aggressively expanded its strategic presence into Eastern Europe and the Balkans, including into Albania. Albania had been ruled by the communist dictator Enver Hoxha for decades, who proclaimed Albania to be the first officially atheist state in the world and who actively persecuted all religious activity. Despite this severe repression, Hoxha was not successful in extinguishing the religious beliefs of the Albanians, particularly the Muslim population. After the collapse of communist rule, Albanians revived religious life and re-established connections with their fellow Muslim brethren in the Muslim Ummah, particularly with Iran, Turkey, and Saudi Arabia. This caused an alarm in the United States and Europe, who feared the emergence of a majority Muslim country on the European continent with close strategic relations with the mentioned Muslim nations. A strategic campaign was initiated by the United States and its vassals to first strategically deny Albania to the Muslim world and to once again de-Islamize Albania, this time by using the excuse of fighting terrorism to ban all contacts between official Albanian Muslim organizations with any Muslim organizations from Iran, Turkey, and Arab countries. After the failure of the US-backed and Emirati-financed coup d'etat in Turkey against President Erdogan, the religious affairs of the Sunni Muslims in Albania was handed over to the pro-US and pro-Zionist Gulenist cult headquartered in the US state of Pennsylvania, a cult which played a key role in the attempted coup d'etat in Turkey. All Albanian Muslim clerics who opposed the imposition of the Gulenist cult on their country were persecuted, imprisoned, or exiled. The US also forced the Albanian government to accept the permanent encampment of the remnants of the Rajavi terrorist cult on its soil, a cult responsible for the murder of over 17,000 people in Iran since the 1970s, a terrorist cult that the Iraqi government expelled after the end of Saddam's rule because of its crimes against the Iraqi people during that era. Albania was forced to accept them after literally no other country in the world would accept them on their soil. The US strategic campaign for Albania also weaponized the legitimate feelings of Albanians and the Albanian majority population in neighboring Kosovo to turn that region into a base against Serbia and Russia. In pursuit of these strategies, the United States, through its embassy and through organizations such as the Soros Foundation, has captured and bought the Albanian political leadership, similar to the fashion it bought and captured elites in countries such as Ukraine. This puppet elite is committing the same crimes and abuses that other US-backed elites in other Muslim nations are committing, with the same result of turning the people against anyone and anything related to America. It appears the Albanian people are beginning to resist this US diktat and will eventually replace the current leadership controlled by the US with leaders who will re-establish relations with important Muslim nations in accordance with Albania's real national interests and the deep-held religious beliefs of its people.
Dr. Yazici, thank you so much for joining us. You know, there's not many programs done on Albania. It's a relatively small country. It's one that maybe the big news organizations might not want to spend a lot of time on. It is also one of those countries which is very interestingly completely dominated by the West. A lot of stories going on there that if it was in any other country, it would be headline news. And yet we see that absolutely nothing is talked about it. And you've, of course, done a lot of interesting work on this in terms of the articles you've written and the research you've done. Also very brave of you to do this, given the situation that exists in Albania. You at the moment are not in Albania, maybe for good reasons also. So I think what's important is that we talk about Albania and maybe just get the facts out in the first instance to our viewers about what's really going on in Albania, which you will then lay out for us. And also then maybe spend a little time analyzing it, maybe more than just getting the information out, talking about why is it that it is the way it is, and what could be in the future. It's very interesting. You've described the leaders in Albania as our little Zelenskys, which is a very interesting but also very entertaining way of stating a fact that maybe we have an elite, we are dealing with an elite in Albania, which has been completely captured by the West and by the Americans. So if you could please, to start us off, give us a brief introduction into what's going on what's going on in Albania. What are the issues as far as you have been able to report them and talk to them about, and let us know what's going on in Albania for our viewers.
Well, first of all, thank you for inviting me. Albania is probably the oldest and the only fully recognized Muslim majority country in Europe. Albania was created as a country in 1913, after the First Balkan War, when the powers of Europe did not know what to do with the Muslims of Europe. But from the moment that Albania was created, it was an experimental state. Albania was not allowed to be a Muslim country, even though we are majority Muslim. We were cut from the rest of the Muslim Ummah. We were secularized. Islam was removed, and Albania was treated as an Italian colony until Second World War. After the Second World War, Albania became part of the Soviet Union. We were an independent country. We were a country that supported Palestine, supported the Islamic Revolution of Iran, even though the country was atheist and Stalinist. The ruler of Albania, Enver Hoxha, praised Imam Khomeini as a great revolutionary and leader of the Muslim world. And Albania played a very important role on denouncing American and Israeli imperialism in the Middle East. But what happened in Albania in 1991, with the fall of the Soviet Union, we had a regime change. And the Americans removed the communist government that we had, and they promised that they will bring democracy to us. Nevertheless, what happened after the first decade of 1990s, in 2000, when American foreign policy towards the world of Islam changed, American policies towards Albania changed as well. While in 1990s, Albania enjoyed freedom, democracy, and in a way, country was re-Islamized. Muslims, people like me, because we were not allowed to keep Muslim names during time of communism, so we discovered our Islamic roots. Countries like Turkey, Iran, Saudi Arabia came and helped the Muslim community to revive itself. Nevertheless, starting from the year 2000 and onwards, the Americans, and in particular the Soros Foundation, they intervened in our local democracy. We had a civil war in 1996-97 in the country. And from that moment, they brought to power the ex-communists who were socialists. Together with them, they brought Edi Rama to power, the person who now is our prime minister, who was a close friend of George Soros and international bankers, friends of Soros. Now, after the coming of Rama to power, he came together with Fatos Nano in the year 2000, and then he came back to power in 2014. The governments that have been formed in Albania under the ruling Socialist Party of Edi Rama, they have been dominated by U.S. Embassy and Soros Foundation. So if you know Albanian politics, most ministers that we have, the evangelical and Zionist mayor of Tirana, Erion Beliaj, they are all handpicked by the U.S. Embassy in Tirana, and they are byproduct of Soros Foundation. So why I call them Zelenskys? I call them Zelenskys because at the same way as the Americans and Soros and other Zionist bankers installed to power a clone like Vladimir Zelensky, the same thing the Americans have done in Albania, but not only, even in Kosovo, in Macedonia, in Montenegro, and many countries in the Balkans. So we in Eastern Europe, we don't have a democracy anymore for somebody to elect it, to be elected as a member of parliament in Albania, but in Kosovo as well. Your name have to pass through U.S. Embassy or Soros Foundation. So what has happened to us in Eastern Europe, and in particular in Albania, since the year 2000 and onward, we have undergone a massive change into our system. Number one, what the Americans have done with us in Eastern Europe, they have destroyed democracy. Number two is they destroyed the socialist economy that we had. In time of communism, we in Eastern Europe, we enjoyed free housing provided by the state, free healthcare, free education. But especially since 2014, when Edi Rama took power as a prime minister in our country, he have destroyed the social health welfare of our state. We no longer have free healthcare in the country, no longer we have a free university education. And moreover, people like our Prime Minister Edi Rama, who has been a member of Soros Foundation, and his wife, Linda Rama, she has been the director-in-chief of Soros Foundation in Albania. The strategy that Americans have followed from Albania to Ukraine is debt entrapment. So what they do is they have put our countries from Ukraine to Albania into huge debts, and as a result, they are increasing prices. So if, let us say, in Albania, 10 or 20 years ago, we paid for our water bill in a month probably $3 to $4. Nowadays, an average Albanian citizen pays like $20 a month. What is happening is that countries like Ukraine or Albania have been enslaved by international bankers, people whom the Soros Mafia brings along, and they use a strategy of, number one, destruction of our local economies, imposition of their puppets into power, and imposition of the policies that Soros and Washington wants people in Eastern Europe to follow.
Dr. Yazici, let's talk a little bit about some of these policies, because we know, let's give it some substance and meat in terms of what's going on there. Why don't we start, maybe if you could explain for us, how they were able to hand the entire religious, the Muslim part of the religious life in Albania to the Gulenist cult, one that was unsuccessful. They tried to do it in Turkey to make to turn Turkey into this base for this, what we would in Iran call American Islam.
And they were unsuccessful in Turkey with the policies that the Erdogan government took there and the arrests that they made after the coup d'etat. But what they ended up doing is they handed Albania to the Gulenists. So if you could talk about that, and also if you could talk about, which is maybe more important for us in Iran, is how is it that the Rajavi terrorist cult, which was, you know, in Iraq and is currently also in Paris, the leadership is in Paris, but the people that were brainwashed into this cult that lived in Iraq for 40 years, how is it that they've ended up in Albania now? Why Albania?
Well, the history of Islam in Albania is complicated. During time of communism, Albania was declared an atheist state. In 1990s, when democracy came, Albanians embraced Islam again. Majority of Albanians are Sunni Muslims, but a large group of Bektashi Muslims exist. And the Bektashis, they are Shia Ithna Ashari Sufi sect. And in 1990s and in early 2000, Albanian Muslims established bridges with the Muslim Ummah, with countries like Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and in particular Turkey and Iran. The bridges that Muslims of Albania built with the Muslim Ummah worried the Americans a lot. And in the 2000s, when Bush declared his global war on terror, which was a war on Islam, the Americans started a project in Albania to take control of the Muslim community of Albania. The Muslim community of Albania is the state institution, like in Iran, you have the Seminary of Qom, which manages Islam. From 2003 to 2005, I have been advisor to the Chief Mufti of Albania. And I have witnessed firsthand how the Americans, by using the anti-terror police of our country, removed from the structures of our Sunni Muslim community the clerics who were educated in the Arab world, but even in Turkey. There was a project which the Albanian and the American government coordinated together, which aimed to give control of Islam in Albania to the Gulenist sect. The Gulenist sect were brought in Albania for a number of reasons. First, they were brought as a pilot project in order to fight the revolutionary Islam, which started to grow in Albania in early 2000. By revolutionary Islam, I mean Muslims who were sympathetic to policies of Turkey and Iran and the Muslim Brotherhood in the Middle East. The Americans do not want a revolutionary Islam to exist in Europe, and in particular in Albania, which is the only Muslim-majority country after Kosovo in Europe. So what they did is they brought the Gulenists in the structure of the Muslim community, and they gave to the Gulenists control over the madrasas and the only Islamic university that we have in Albania, Badr University. I have written several articles for the Yearbook of Muslims in Europe, where I analyze Islam in Albania. And the declarations that many Albanian politicians have done in years show that the US embassy instructed our leaders in early 2000 to remove through illegal forms the clerics from the structures of the Muslim community who were educated in Arab countries or even in Turkey. I'm talking here about the Sunni Muslims.
That's right.
And to replace them with the Gulenists. Now, when in 2016 we had the coup d'etat in Turkey against the democratically elected government of Erdogan, and from this moment onward, but even before that, Turkey was very concerned about the presence of the Gulenists. Now, I have to explain to your viewers that the present ambassador, U.S. ambassador in Albania, Yuri Kim, she was a close friend to Osman Kavala, one of the people who is jailed in Turkey, accused of organizing the coup. So, especially after 2016, Albania has become a base of the Gulenists, and the American ambassador is one of the chief persons who, in a way, coordinated the coup against democracy in Turkey. And in this moment that we're speaking, there are many protests in Albania by Muslim clerics who want to have their position in the Muslim community, but they are not allowed. The elections in our Muslim community, whenever we have, they are done under the supervision of the U.S. Embassy and anti-terror police. So clerics who are educated in Sunni countries like Malaysia, Turkey, or the Arab world, they are not allowed to enter into this institution. So imagine if the Americans would have done this to Iran, to force a sect in Qom and to prohibit other clerics from having access.
They actually tried to do that during the Shah, but of course they were not successful. So,
yes.
So also then please explain to us, because we have an actual terrorist cult organization now that is in Albania. Again, for us in Iran, very important, because they killed 17,000 people in Iran, which is the Rajavi cult that used to be in Iraq. And when the Saddam regime was overthrown by the U.S., they end up in Albania. How did that happen? If you could give us a little background on them coming to Albania. And by the way, sorry, doctor, we have to also mention, a lot of these people are brainwashed, because what ended up happening is a lot of them, when they got off the plane or when they arrived in Albania, they actually defected. They ran away because it was the first time that they were allowed to leave that encampment that they had lived in for decades. In Iraq, they weren't even allowed to leave that encampment in Iraq during the decades that they lived there. So the minute they got off the plane, or the minute they entered Albania, approximately half of them, this is what the media was reporting, approximately half of them actually fled from that cult and sought asylum in different parts of Europe.
Yeah, you are correct. Rajavi cult was brought in Albania. They started to come since 2013. At first, the Americans brought them to Albania under the excuse that they had to bring only some of their leaders. But then the bulk of this cult was brought under the Obama administration, and it was the Secretary of State John Kerry who came to Albania and brought 3,000 of them. The Americans had big problem with Iraq, because Iraqis knew very well who the Rajavi cult were, and they have committed many crimes against the people of Iraq.
That's right.
They were looking for a safe haven for these terrorists. They tried to send these terrorists in many countries. They approached Macedonia, Romania, probably even Ukraine, but many countries of Eastern Europe simply refused to host these terrorists. So they brought them to Albania. Now, the question that many international scholars ask is, why Albania? The reason is simple. The Albanian government is a mafia government. For people who know local Albanian politics, most of our politicians, we have even government ministers, are drug dealers and who involve themselves in drug trafficking.
Thank you for joining us on this episode. Until the next time on Insight.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked among
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant factor.
Imamat yek asl zinda ast dar tarikh Islam.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulema's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
در آیه 64 سوره اسراء این دو نقشه رو اینجوری خداوند متعال بیان کرده.
In Surah Isra, Ayah 64, we read, "Instigate whomever of them you can with your voice, and rally against them your cavalry and your infantry, and share with them in wealth and children, and make promises to them. But Satan promises them nothing but delusion." Here, Satan wants to create two types of corruption, namely financial and sexual. Regarding the financial corruption, that Satan is after creating unlawful and illegitimate income, saving, salary, and investment in a society, and to show them as something normal. The Satan thus this through bribery, embezzlement, hoarding, usury, short-selling, and different types of financial corruption.
کسی که حرام خور باشه، این یواش یواش پوک میشه و میتونه سرباز شیطان بشه.
A person who earns haram income gradually becomes the infantry of the Satan. You can see this case in the army of Yazid in Karbala events. They were all after the haram mouthful and earning up to an extent that they killed the grandson of Rasulullah. Even Imam al-Hussein on the scene of Karbala addressed the army of the enemy and said to them, "Your bellies are filled with haram food and earnings." This is how the Satan deceives the believers through financial corruption. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hojatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.